Welcome to the Alcohol Free Life podcast, brought to you by thesoberclub.com. I'm Genuinely Grace. This is for you if you've quit the booze or you'd like to, or maybe you're just sober curious. I'll bring you tips and motivation without any judgment, and there'll be inspiration from experts, quitlet authors, and sober heroes. Hi and welcome to the podcast. I hope you're well. I sound slightly better than I did last week. but yeah, God, what an horrible cold. It went on for ages. I know lots of people have been suffering. And I finally, after, oh my goodness, so many years, addressed a whole load of issues I've had going on with my mouth, dental stuff. Oh, we don't even want to hear that word, do we? So I've got a lot of dental work that I've got to get sorted out. And it's really made me think, you know, I really think that's one of the things that I've been putting off, or I did put off for years and years and years. I've been a little bit better in recent years. But when I was drinking, I just always put that stuff off. And I think it really takes its toll on you. I've absolutely no doubt that a whole, you know, host of my issues are due to the fact that I was drinking so much and just not taking care of myself, not going to see the hygienist regularly and all of that stuff. And it comes back to bite you on the bum, doesn't it, all this? And I do think it's part of self-care. I really do. As time goes on, the more I realise that all these kind of basics of just properly taking care of ourselves, we don't do them when we're over drinking. We really don't. We kind of think we do. And I think I went through that a phase, well, a long time actually, where I was convinced that I was doing everything right for my health, you know, queen of holistic living, eating well and lots of great supplements and doing my yoga and not putting any chemicals on my skin and on and on and on. But I was really kind of in denial because literally, I was stepping around the elephant in the room that was alcohol, that was, you know, insidiously affecting my gums and God knows what else. So, I mean, I really enjoyed ticking the box on the dentist form that says, how many units of alcohol do you drink? Naught. You know, we got to get our kicks in little ways, haven't we? But anyways, yeah, so that's been it's a hell of a thing I've got going on. So I hope you feel sorry for me. Maybe you've got something similar happening. But, you know, I had to reframe it. I don't think anyone loves the dentist, do they? And particularly not if you've got some pretty difficult, invasive and very expensive work to do. But I think ultimately, you just got to put your big girl pants on, really, and be grateful that whatever it is can be sorted out. That's how I feel now. Of course, if I had my time again, I'd have stopped drinking a lot sooner, or preferably not ever even started at all. And then maybe I wouldn't be in such bad shape. So yeah, that's been a big lesson for me this week. And I'm just about to launch my little course, my Tapping Into Self-Care online group coaching program. And I'm going to incorporate some more of this stuff in that course, because obviously we're going to be using EFT, Emotional Freedom Technique, and lots of other techniques. But I'm also going to include some of these real basics around our daily stuff, you know, because self-care is absolutely not just your spa days and your getting to the sea, although of course they're very important. Getting to the sea is very important for me, but it's the little things. It's the how you actually look at your life, how you value all of the little things, and certainly how you value your health. It's you know, it's mega important, isn't it? So that'll be included. If you did want to join us on that program, we start our live coaching sessions on Wednesday the 9th, so you've still got time to join us. We've got a dedicated WhatsApp group as well, lots of pre-recorded stuff, and three live sessions. So yeah, check it out. It's called Tapping Into Self-Care if you go to thesoberclub.com. Be lovely to have you involved wherever you are in the world, whatever stage you're at, doesn't matter. We're focusing on reducing stress and anxiety, just focusing on self-care, focusing on what's next, what we want for our lives. And if you've been sober for a while, that kind of new thing of, sometimes it feels new, of having to embrace your sober identity, which can be a thing for sure when we're not quite sure who we are in the early weeks. Anyways, check it out. There's been a fair bit in the press this week about alcohol. I don't know if you saw the piece a couple of weeks ago about the surge in liver disease, which they're saying is from lockdown drinking. So they're just kind of seeing the fallout now and saying that there's a 20% increase since the year before. And the highest increase since the records began of liver disease, which is just awful, just absolutely shocking. And then this week there was a piece about the young, so the young at risk of stroke, and they're actually admitting here that even one drink a day can have an impact. The article talks about how young adults who have one drink a day could be raising their risk of a stroke by a fifth. This is what the report is saying. And I think I read somewhere in this same report that they're saying that the British charity, the charity Stroke, says one in five people who have strokes are now under the age of 55. That's pretty shocking, isn't it? We tend to think of it as something that happens to people when they're much older. So I don't have any doubt that alcohol impacts, but it's good to see sometimes in the press where they actually admit that that even one drink is going to have an impact. They don't always kind of make those equations, do they? But certainly after my podcast with Dr. Anya Topiwala, I make no bones now about just telling it like it is. I think that was just such a powerful conversation. If you haven't listened, please go back and have a listen to that podcast where I interview Dr. Anya Topiwala, who is the clinical lead researcher on a study and a psychotherapist herself, where she didn't pull any punches. She was really honest. She said, you know, this is what studies show, that alcohol has zero benefits. Don't give me that crap about a glass of red wine being good for the heart. It's absolute BS. She makes it absolutely clear, even one glass will have an impact. It's aging. It has all kinds of impacts on health, both physically and emotionally. She goes into great detail. So have a listen if you haven't before. That's just in case you were under any illusions. But I'm guessing that a lot of people listening to this podcast are at least sober curious, at least starting to think that way, or maybe you've been sober for years and you just love having more inspiration, which is fantastic. I really hope you're going to love this week's podcast. Tom Bowen is a former Calvin Klein model and musician and has quite a story to tell. And so fascinating, the work that he's doing now as the sober guitar coach. It was great to chat to Tom. It's not often you get to talk to musicians who have been in kind of some of the similar worlds that I've been in, who have come through their kind of rock and roll days and come out the other side and really now making such a difference. So enjoy the interview. Well, I'm really pleased that my guest is Tom Bowen, who's a former Calvin Klein model, no less, musician and the sober guitar coach. I can't wait for this, Tom. Just fascinating stuff to chat about. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Good. Yeah, really good. Nice to see your background as we record this with all your kit laid out, your keyboard and your guitars. Looks really cool. We'll have to start with the modeling stuff because everyone's thinking, well, Calvin Klein. So come on then, he got his kit off, did he? Tell us all about your modeling days.
Most of it came off. He put me in a pair of underpants and I ended up on the side of a bus and on a billboard and on the telly.
What year was this then, Tom?
That was in 1995, and it had nothing to do with me. It all happened completely by accident. I was minding my own business as a teenager, flicking through records in Portobello Market, and just got approached by a rather sort of nondescript and perhaps a little bit odd fella. And
so an actual scout, an actual model scout.
Well, he was a photographer. He is a photographer, but it was exactly the sort of thing your mum and dad say not to do, which, as a teenager in London.
I
was already ignoring what my parents told me to do generally and still am.
So. Oh, how funny. So, and what happened after that then? Did you sign up with a big modelling agency or how did it pan out?
Eventually, I signed up with a few, one in London and then further afield abroad. But it took a while. I mean, I kind of looked like I do now. I had long hair and I don't go to the gym. And at the time, 30 years ago, we were quite unusual. It wasn't long after Kate Moss had kind of got her start, and so. Mm. Fellas just sort of followed suit, really. The women led the way and I was one of the first guys to to sort of not look like a superhero. But
so did you do kind of catwalk modelling as well as photographic?
Yeah. So to begin with, the photographer who found me, we did editorial shoots for magazines such as ID and The Face.
God, I remember those mags. Yeah. They were great, weren't they?
They were great. They were really very much of their time.
Yeah, they really were.
In the early 90s. So it was just a bunch of youngsters having fun, really. I mean, he was a bit older than me. He is a bit older, but, you know, he was still in his 20s. And we did that kind of work, which, so those magazines were seen and, you know, are still seen by the designers, the people in New York and Paris. And so that, you know, it just naturally led. And I signed with an agent along the way. The agent needed to be convinced of a long-haired, you know, Black Crowes Primal Scream fan from Cardiff and was going to be a model. But yeah, it just slowly kind of turned into successful model.
And then where did the music come in then?
Well, I was already doing that. I was I was a kid running wild and playing truant like lots of us do in Cardiff in the late 80s, early 90s. And yeah, just instead of going to school, I just went and hung out in guitar shops, and they tolerated me. They were very kind. And I had some friends who I fell in with, and we started a band. So that was kind of, they were kind of both, they dovetailed really. It was around about the same time, sort of early 92, 93.
Mm-hmm. And what happened with the music career then? Excuse my ignorance, I don't actually know what you did musically.
You wouldn't do, why would you? I was mostly in support bands. When people asked me what bands was I in, they were mostly support bands. It's just sheer luck, and you know what, you need 99% luck and 1% talent to get anywhere. You know you're a singer. But I did do everything I set out to do. You know, I travelled, made some recordings with my friends, had a lot of fun with, you know, friends that I was in bands with, rather than some of the other work, which was more like session work
as a guitarist.
Yeah, so yeah. The modelling kind of came to a natural conclusion, and I was living in London, and it was the mid 90s by that point, and so, you know, it was just that it was quite an exciting time. There's a lot going on. You know, you throw a stone in Camden Town, you take a musician.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, completely. So tell us a little bit about life across that time then. So I'm guessing somewhere along the line you started drinking, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, just like most people, you know, 14 13 14, after school in the park, getting up to no good, like we all did. And I suppose I can pinpoint a feeling about alcohol particularly, that it just felt like an answer, a solution to a problem that I didn't know I had. And I'm paraphrasing a guy called Chris from the Dopey podcast there, who's a real hero. But it was just very, we were all experimenting with everything we could get hold of. The drugs that weren't available, we didn't try just purely because you couldn't get them in Cardiff in 1991 or whatever. But so certain friends were keen on certain substances. For me, alcohol just felt right. It just felt really comfortable. And then, you know, it's just part of the lifestyle. It's an occupational hazard for musicians, or it was. I don't think it's as hip now. I don't think the youngsters think it's cool to be elegant and wasted.
No, well, a lot of millennials don't drink at all, do they?
No.
Or certainly more mindful drinking. But yeah, you're right. I mean, the music biz was just what everyone did. Mind you, I say that to people sometimes, and then they go, yeah, well, you want to look at the medical profession. And, oh, yeah, okay. True. And then they go, and look at the teaching profession. Yeah. So actually, I think it's rife everywhere. It's just that the difference is, for musos, we get it free. Well, it was always free, right?
There's that. I think for us, I mean, since I've been in recovery, what I came to realise was that is true. And yes, everybody, you know, it's rife in every single walk of life imaginable. Yeah. But I can't think of very many other vocational pursuits or professions that you work at night in licensed premises.
Yeah,
And
true.
it's not so much that you're encouraged to indulge. In those days, you were almost, bullied into it, or
Yeah.
considered it odd, or some kind of freak or weirdo if you didn't.
Yeah.
So it was, when I was a working musician, the only times I played sober were doing something like this, doing a regional
Yeah, radio or something,
radio
yeah.
show. And
No,
even
it's
then,
absolutely true.
you'd quite likely still be under the influence from the night before. So.
Yeah, I know, it's really true. I mean, oh God, I mean, when I think back, I think I was a little bit actually, the truth of it is, I was afraid. I was really afraid of being out of control, really afraid. And that's why I never tried drugs, despite the fact that, I was in bands and all the rest of it. And the honest truth is that I was terrified of not being in control. But of course, you see everyone on alcohol and seemingly okay. So again, that felt like, that was fine. But I remember, sort of when I was gigging with when I was working with quite a few different bands, there would be some bands, I won't name them, but I remember one band that I was touring with. I mean, literally, that you the vibe was, you go in the dressing room and you have just a shed load of alcohol, and like the rider was just all alcohol and Coke, just all literally chopped out there. Oh, what the hell? I mean,
Have we met
when I think
before?
back now, it's like I used to be terrified to sneeze, right? Maybe I should have done. And so I was just seen as like, oh, the goody two shoes, backing singer who, like, oh, yeah. And it was awful. It was absolutely awful. I mean, that was the you kind of sober shaming inverted back then. Yeah. It is incredible, really, when you think about it.
That could have been me for all I know.
Yeah.
I don't know if I was, maybe we've met before, I don't
Yeah,
know.
maybe. Quite
But
well,
that
quite
was the
possibly.
life. That was the norm for me and my friends.
Yeah, really incredible, isn't it? So what happened then in more recent years? What happened that kind of made you realize maybe enough?
Well, I mean, going back to the teenage years, pre-internet, the only kind of guide to the rock star or the musician's life were rock and roll biography. So, and in the late 80s, that's when a lot of my heroes were getting sober. So people like Keith Richards, or not so much Keith Richards, but Clapton, people of their generation, they were in rehab, or they were, Clapton opened a rehab. And then, so it was kind of expected. The lifestyle was what, your path was laid out for you, and you kind of knew that if you sailed too close to the wind, you'd have that crossroads put in front of you of whether or not to continue, and if you were going to be all right. And what happened to me was I just was consumed with the lifestyle. Along the way, I got married and divorced. As I mentioned earlier, it's making it as a musician was it's just luck. So as much as I put myself in the right place at what I thought was the right time, it didn't always work out. It never really did work out. But that, it depends how you measure success. It did work out because I had some great experiences, some amazing gigs, made a record with my friends. But yeah, I got married, got divorced, and in between gigs and record deals, I did any job I could find to buy the guitar strings, and so went from being a young guy in his 20s and early 30s, living the lifestyle, to being a married guy in his 30s and 40s, working and being married and mortgages and so on and so forth. And so that's much harder to reconcile with the life. And I just it just evolved and grew into alcoholism and drug addiction. So, and with our society, whether you're staying home and cooking of a Sunday evening with your wife, or making a Sunday roast and drinking red wine, and getting slowly sozzled and comfortably sozzled listening to your favorite radio shows, or whether you're out scoring drugs and passing out somewhere, I was doing both of those things. But it just evolves. It's something that kind of grew and grew and grew until my life became unmanageable.
And did you, would you say you had a sort of rock bottom moment, or, you know,
had a few.
Did you? Right.
I had a few. There were certainly warning signs. I mean, one of the most dangerous things, I think, is stigma about mental health and about addiction. I think that kills as many people as anything else does. A rock bottom would have been a heroin overdose, intravenous heroin use. I nearly died then. And then at the end of 2019, my GP gave me a year to live.
She said, wow.
If you don't change your ways, if you don't make some changes, I would be surprised to get my last email or phone call about you.
Were they actually offering you the right kind of support?
On the NHS, yes. They signposted me to an organisation that's now called We Are With You, which is great. And I'm a carer for my mum, and I was at that point as well. So I had somewhat limited options in terms of detox and detoxification and rehabilitation and recovery. So I knew I couldn't go to rehab. Or I found out I couldn't go to rehab because you're expected to surrender your phone.
Your life.
You can't be online. You know, you can't be available at the end of the phone if something happens. So. Wow. That wasn't an option, but yeah, the NHS were great. They gave me the numbers and the information that I needed.
Well, that's really good to hear. I mean, I don't work with many people who have, you know, kind of at that stage at rock bottom. Mm. But it's good to know that there is something. Mm. You know, I think, I mean, my experience from the clients that I work with is that for those of us who are sort of grey area drinkers, you know, we're not at rock bottom, thank God, or were, the NHS are hopeless. They've got no idea. They don't understand it. They don't, you know, have that concept of, well, why don't you stop now? Because life is better without. They have no idea what to do with you. But I have heard other people say that, you know, once things get tough, they do know where to refer. So that is good to hear. But I've also heard other people say, just as you said then, what they were offered just didn't fit their life. One woman that I was working with was holding down a full-time job. I mean, just about, right? Just about holding down a full-time job. So, you know, that really was her lifeline. And thank God she was doing that. But the only support she was offered was, you know, sort of a Tuesday afternoon kind of thing. It's not going to work.
Well, so, I think the NHS are doing everything they can, despite being under Tory rule.
Underfunded.
That's another conversation for another podcast another time. Get the Tories out.
But you got some support then.
I did. I was able to attend a daily rehab, which is CBT paste, funded by the local authority on a community farm, which was wonderful. You know, it was AA without the AA framework, which it was an alternative rehabilitation, but it was pretty much the same thing. It was a room full of people being empathetic with each other, discussing their lives in and out of addiction. So it was, you know, I'm an advocate for anything that works.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it was great. It was wonderful. Unfortunately, this was in early 2020. So after a month of going there every day,
lockdown
like everywhere else. Yeah. God. But I mean, fear is a great motivator, and being told you're going to die if you don't sort yourself out.
Yeah.
So it was
that
a
is a motivator.
Yeah. You know, so I was lucky. Yes, I was luckily, I was helped by my doctors and the charity that I went to. And Catherine Gray's book was...
Unexpected Joy of Being Sober. Awesome, isn't it?
Yeah.
Brilliant.
And from there on, actually, it was a theme of following my sisters, really. The Sober Fish group were really supportive. I think it was the following year that I hung out with those, and I'm still a fish follower.
So I think I think you know what you've just sort of outlined is great, because you know it's something I talk about a lot. It doesn't matter what route you take, you know, but what matters is that you've got that motivation. I wouldn't wish it on anyone. You're only having a year to live, but you know what can work for some people is that sort of pain point. But then also the motivation can be how much you want a better life, and when more people can share that with you, it's great. And then you've also, you know, added in another thing that I go on all the time, which is that, you know, that connection piece and just having people to kind of cheerlead you means everything, doesn't it, really?
Absolutely. I mean, friends and family and support are key. And I do think that it's about a lack of ignorance.
Yeah.
Or getting rid of the stigmas involved. And I might have to edit this. I've lost my train of thought.
That's all right. No, it doesn't matter. We like just kind of, you know, discussions here. It doesn't matter. One of my mates does a podcast and it's just so fantastic listening to it because you'll be listening. And then he'll just go and answer the door.
I was just about to make a point then.
And then the dog will bark. They have a whole conversation with the dog and actually it makes it very relaxed.
So. Yeah, it makes things natural, doesn't it? I work like this. You know, when I'm teaching, and most of my work's on Zoom.
Yeah, brilliant. Well, we'll talk about your work in a minute. Let me just ask you, you know, when you got sober, what was the reaction from, you know, sort of, I don't know, friends, musician friends, contemporaries, if you were still connected with them, and whether you were or you weren't, was that a thing for you? You know, was that something that you were concerned about? Because I think it can so often be the thing that holds people back. They're so concerned about what their friends will think of them, because in a sense you've got a new identity. You've got a whole new identity.
Absolutely, I have. I mean, and in some ways I've got my old identity back.
Well, you're back to the real you.
Yeah, exactly. Back to the kid with the guitar age 15, just before he got into trouble with substances. It was a mixed bag of reactions. I already was talking to friends who got years and decades under their belts. So there was already, I had to do a fair bit of planning ahead of my recovery because of my responsibilities as a carer. I couldn't just kind of drop everything. Some reactions, I mean, I was bored of the pub. I was bored of the same conversations and the same jobs with the same people. So, and that's just really typical of most people who, specifically with alcohol, they lose people that they thought were friends. Maybe they weren't necessarily anything more than drinking buddies.
Well, absolutely.
And I find that the ones that were more than drinking buddies are still around, you know.
Yeah, good.
I think it's still a case that it's so ingrained in society. It's such a norm to be consuming a substance that's just as harmful, if not more harmful, than illegal ones. It's so normal that when people are confronted with somebody who's decided to make the change, it frightens them. It holds up a mirror to their own habits that they're perhaps not ready to face. I mean, I see it as a spectrum anyway. I don't have any objection to the term grey area. But in terms of going from a grey area to a rock bottom, I don't think it necessarily is a very long way from one.
Oh God, no. I agree. I absolutely agree.
I was certainly in a black area. It was very dark.
It's called a booze elevator, isn't it? It's like if you see it like a lift and you are, it's literally just going down and you've no idea. It could take one small thing to tip you from where you are to the bottom, literally. If you're someone who drinks every day and uses, in inverted commas, alcohol to numb feelings, pain, every time you're happy, every time you're sad, you know, effectively you're using it for something that you feel it fill a gap, you feel it fills, then it only takes one real big thing to happen. and that's your crutch. That's what you use. So you literally can go straight down to the bottom. I absolutely agree.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, it's interesting. But it's interesting that, you know, you, as you say, the friends who were the real friends hung on.
Exactly. It's a great filter. It's a leveler, you know.
It is. Well, tell us about the fabulous work you do now. I love the idea of the sober guitar coach. Tell us about the kind of stuff that you do.
It's a lovely thing to do. It's a privilege. I've been a guitar teacher on and off for about 15 years. It was something I discovered I could do. I was pretty much raised by three teachers. My mum, my great aunt and my gran were all teachers. So I don't know if there's something genetic there. I was a working musician in London, but sort of between, it was a career dip, I guess. And I was working in two different pubs and three different secondhand clothes shops. And somebody asked me for a guitar lesson. He'd seen me playing slide guitar in a bar. He was already a guitarist, and I was working, you know, a menial job for minimum wage. And it, I wasn't a great bartender. I was better on the other side of the bar. And I just went to see him and just found it really instantly kind of just as natural as as going to see him if I was going to see him for to start a band or to write a song together or something like that. So it was just really easy. It came very naturally to me. And from there, I just started. This was in 2005, so some really bog standard flyers, and I printed those on a laptop and took those to record shops and music venues, pubs that had music, and just started going to see people and showing them how to play. And that's kind of all I've ever done. The way that I work is it's transferable skills. It's like anything, really. I take my knowledge from having taught myself largely how to play, and from having sat in rehearsal rooms and flats and bed sits and having a musical conversation with another musician. And that's all I do. It just happens to be with nowadays with people who are just starting out.
Yeah. So you do you work with beginners as well as people
not
who already
exclusively
play.
It's mostly people who are learning, but I work with people who are already active musicians.
Yeah.
Already.
So any kind of guitar, acoustic guitar, electric, everything?
Acoustic and electric. Yeah. Pretty much any sort of subgenre of pop and rock is what I play. I don't play metal or jazz, but it's not because I don't like them. They're just quite difficult.
Yeah. You know, if someone is starting out, or if someone has maybe coming back to it, how expensive is it to get started? Like, you know, what kind of level of guitar would you need? You know, what kind of price would you be needing to pay, do you reckon?
There are some really good budget guitars nowadays. I don't have endorsements with any companies, but the makes that you'd expect, the famous ones like Gibson and Fender, they offer they're traditionally known as junior models. They're very, very well made and very reasonably priced nowadays. You don't have to spend a lot. However, it's like anything, the more you spend, the better quality instrument you're going to get. It's a fallacy that parents sometimes will think, my mum and dad were the same, well, we'll get him a cheap one. And if he sticks at it, we'll get him something better, you know, and he can save up. And but it's simply a matter of, you know, you wouldn't buy a cheap pair of scissors or a cheap screwdriver that didn't do the job properly. Yeah. You want a guitar that's going to stay in tune. So it's the better it'll be.
Mm. So tell us about, you know, the name then, the Sober Guitar Coach. Where does that
come in? It's just what I am. I'm not a qualified anything. I've just got 30 years experience as a musician, and so I see it as coaching, because teacher lessons, they're academic terms.
Yeah.
And whilst I'm not against the formalization of music, what I offer is my experience, and it's very informal. And most of my influences and heroes, that's how they did it as well.
Who are your influences and heroes?
I've got loads. I mean, there's so many, but off the top of my head, people like Muddy Waters and Chuck Berry, who were the architects of pop music. I don't know if they could read English, let alone read music. I've no idea. Maybe they could, maybe they couldn't. I'd imagine they could. But what I mean in general is that the experience I offer isn't... There are several different ways to learn anything, and some people may be academic with another subject, but with a guitar, they'll just see what I'm doing and be able to pick it up by observing and listening. So that's fine. I do work with an alternative method of reading music, which is known as tablature. It's very, very well known.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. Sure.
And that's just the diagram of the strings and the frets. But it's the sober aspect of it It's just that's my life now. It's been 3 years since I changed my lifestyle. It's a year since I stopped smoking and nearly 3 years since I stopped drinking and using.
Brilliant.
And
do you want to list a few of the benefits? I know we could be here for days.
Well, sure.
Share a few of the benefits in case anyone's thinking, nah.
Well, it's meditative, and anything that takes you out of yourself is going to help you stay sober. It's going to help you in general. I mean, when I improvise on a guitar, rather than focus and concentrate, I'm able to achieve the same kind of state that I would do if I was meditating. So I'm not really thinking, I'm just experiencing something, I'm doing something. And you don't have to be technical or advanced on an instrument to do that. It may not sound brilliant straight away, but you're just kind of randomly using your muscle memory, your hands, your fingers, to create sounds on this, two pieces of wood bolted together. And it takes practice, like meditation takes practice. Nobody can meditate instantly. So, you know, you give your brain a break and you're using a different part of your brain, but you're not sort of consciously, cognitively thinking. So there's that aspect to it. It's social. It's an escape. It's a physical thing. So you're exercising your muscles and your bones, tendons, that kind of thing.
And I'm guessing, you know, we touched on it earlier, but I'm guessing you would say that your sort of mental health and well-being has improved massively since you
absolutely quit. With learning an instrument, it can absolutely improve your mental health. It can boost your self-esteem because you're achieving something. It's enriching. I mean, you can start talking about enriching the soul and that kind of thing. It's just a pleasant thing to do, and sense of achievement.
But I mean, in terms of since you stopped drinking, your mental health and well-being generally must have really improved
hugely. I think once I've got this time doubled and a little bit more. I think it's about 7 years that the body, there are no cells that have been drunk before, you know. the clarity, the mental clarity, the emotional clarity, sense of calm, things like depression and anxiety hugely reduced.
And you mentioned that you're a carer. Just out of interest, it's something that I, years and years ago, I was working just in like a very part-time thing with a carers association that was a long time ago, just doing a bit of kind of helping them with a bit, supporting with a bit of PR kind of stuff. Is there much support there for you as a carer?
Is there support from where?
Anywhere. Just out of interest. It's nothing to, none of my business and nothing to do with anything. I'm just always interested because I just think there's a huge number of people are carers and just wonder what kind of support there is for you, if any.
I would say no, there isn't. That's a simple answer is no. I did it all myself. I don't know whether that was a matter of being a control freak or, you know, perhaps a bit of approaching it with a musician's head. I don't know, but no, there wasn't really anything available to me. But I think that it was because I became frustrated with the way things are organized and the way things are done. I just wanted to do it myself. And that's something that you learn in recovery, you ought to learn in recovery, that I'm really only learning now, that it, you know, that you need to reach out and get help from people who know what they're doing,
yeah,
what they're talking about, and there's an arrogance perhaps there that it took me a while to get rid of. I mean, there are services out there, lots of them. I just chose to kind of tackle the problems head on in my own way. She's quite a unique lady, my mum, and really only wanted me around.
Must be super proud of you.
Yeah, she is. Thanks. Yeah.
Yeah, Well, it's just fantastic to chat to you. I love it. I love the way you've completely reinvented yourself. It's really cool. And yeah, how exciting that somebody can come and learn guitar. As you say, that none of that sort of academic thing, but just a bit more organically and with someone who's sober. I love that. And do you work online or in person?
Almost totally at the moment, yeah. I'd already been working on Skype just because a friend wanted me to teach his daughter years ago, and we were at opposite ends of Sussex, where I was living in Hastings at the time, and it was just easier to work on Skype. And so when everything went on to Zoom in 2020, it was quite natural for me to do. And so yeah, I'm often awake in the middle of the night working with somebody in LA or but it can be anywhere, and people come here to this room and see me as well.
Cool, brilliant. Well, it's so great to chat to you. Do you want to give us your website if anyone would like to find out any more info?
I'm currently in the middle of overhauling everything online. Okay. The best way to kind of reach me or to see a few videos of me playing and the kind of photographs I like is on Instagram at the moment, and it's just cool. Tom_Bowen_guitar.
Brilliant. I'll pop that in the show notes as well. Thank you so much, Tom. I really appreciate it. Great to chat to you.
Thanks.
Thank you, Tom. Makes me want to have guitar lessons. I did it years and years and years ago when I was a teenager, sort of in my late teens. And all I remember was how difficult it was, because it really hurts your fingers when you first start. Should have said that to Tom, shouldn't I? Yeah, you really got to toughen up, but it's worth it, I guess. So anyways, thanks to Tom for that chat. It was really, really great to chat to him. And another reminder that if you have any suggestions of fantastic guests for me for the podcast, just drop me a message. You can always find me at Janie Lee Grace, or you can find me via the Sober Club. And I'd love to hear your recommendations for anyone who would make a great guest on the podcast. And just a reminder, if you're early stages, if you're doing this thing, it's worth it. We are into November, of course, and some people are calling it November, as in the power of no. That's quite a powerful thing to bear in mind. We can actually say no. It can be an act of kindness to say no. So bear that in mind, particularly if you're a people pleaser and actually you know that you end up drinking to make someone else feel better, or you end up going along to somewhere that is really out of your comfort zone in the early weeks of sobriety. So just harness the power of no, even if you just see that as a challenge for November. You're just going to say no. You're going to say no to going to places you don't want to go to being with people you don't want to be with, to drinking poison that you don't really want to drink. Just listen to your own thoughts and your own, listen to your gut instinct. You know, you always really know. We've got our family constellations on this Sunday. And one of the things that we talk about a lot in constellations is the power of knowing that your body knows the truth. And it is true, you know. I had a little thing in the week where I had some dealings with someone, and it was very uncomfortable. And all I could think to myself was, oh my goodness, I knew this. I knew this when we first connected. My gut instinct was right, and I didn't listen to it, and hence got myself into a bit of a tricky situation. And I think we all have to just remember, we have to listen to our intuition. It's really strong. And when you ask yourself a question, you know, your gut instinct tells you. They do say, don't they, the gut is the second brain. We've got an interview coming up with Dr. Ina Taylor on the impact of gut health, and we talk about that there. The gut is the second brain. She would argue it's the first brain. It's where we kind of process everything. But certainly, if you're actually wanting to know, is this the right thing for me to do? Is it the right time for me to stop drinking? Then ask your gut, ask your instincts. Is it? Just listen to that first answer rather than pushing it away. And similarly, if someone is trying to encourage you to go to somewhere where you know you're going to end up being feeling as though you're sober shamed, you know there'll be no alcohol-free alternatives, you know it's going to be awkward for you, ask yourself, is this the right thing to do? Should I go? And listen, if the answer is no, that's okay. Do something else. Listen to a podcast, read a Quitlet book, go to bed early. There's always another way, right? So I really hope you're well. I hope you have a good week, and I will see you same time next week. You know where to find me on social media. Please rate and review the podcast and all of that stuff. It's at Janie Lee Grace. And of course, if you want connection, support, inspiration, masses of amazing content, then join us at thesoberclub.com. See you soon. Thank you for listening to the Alcohol Free Life podcast, brought to you by The Sober Club. Please rate and review. And if you want support, accountability and inspiration, and you want to live your best life without the booze, check out thesoberclub.com.